Today is the 14th of July, 2008. I'm here in Heberoni with Dr. Kera Tedeswa, in the Coordinator of Public Sector Reform in the Office of the President. So I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your day to sit down with me.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I know you're an exceptionally busy man, and I do appreciate it. And just before we begin with some of the more specific questions I had for you, I wonder if you would mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and the career trajectory that has brought you to this position now.
I am Omponyi Coach Kera Tedeswa, and I'm from the northwest part of Botswana, a place called Nokaneng. I live a life of maybe purpose, and my life purpose is, of course, to assist organizations that I work for, my family, and the world at large to prosper. And the question for me for planting the seed, a teacher by profession, mm-hmm. and an ordinary farmer. And yeah, I have two kids, and boy, girl, and a beautiful wife. And yeah, I regret, and I don't regret for being here, and even at the time when I was conceived, I take it that there were maybe some 400 million, you know, spermatozoa, and of which one made me. And in essence, therefore God had a reason to have me, and it's just to make a difference in people's lives through my life purpose.
Excellent. I'd really be interested to learn a little bit more about this office here, this CPSO. And could you describe a little bit about it, its structure, and the history, and how it was established?
Public Service Reforms Unit. It sounds like it's a unit, but it's a very big structure in terms of function. Mm-hmm. Reforms in this country started way back before independence in 1966, but those were piecemeal in nature and community-based. But you know, enshrined or embedded in our traditional democracy of the traditional quota systems, where the traditional chiefs at that time, you know, under the British protectorate, were able to be innovative in terms of bringing about what you may call development. And I remember even up to 1966, we have close to 6 secondary schools that were built by the community in trying to reform their societies, because most of the children went to South Africa for senior secondary or for secondary education. And as a result, that also affected the kind of employees that we had. We had a lot of foreign-based employees and expatriates, if I may say, and uneducated work staff in terms of the human resource, Botswana than the citizens, mm-hmm. and therefore at independence the focus was education, and to make sure, you know, that we turn things around. But you know, as you know, development is a process, and as such, during this time there was very in other words, the communities or the chiefs themselves, you know, were responsible for their society. But when we started, you know, the African nationalism, when it started in the, of course, late 1950 strongly, but in earnest from around 1948 and so on. Then communities had to survive, and national unity was the way. And that, for me, we don't talk much about that, but that's really that was the beginning of the reform, not necessarily through political structures, but through even families and cross boundaries. People beginning to realize that they can coexist and live as a society. But not digressing too much, what happened then from 1966, there was then the establishment of course the government and the Minister of Finance was mainly, you know, dealing with development planning, and reforms were viewed as such. And there was no private sector at that time. So then around 1976, 1977, we started to see some kind of complacency creeping into the public service. And this was as a result of the citizens now saying, we have a few of us educated, we can take over, but without necessarily sometimes defining how we can do it. Because it's still a process, it's not a matter of I'm educated, there are other things that goes with it. So 80s, there was that, then there was push for expatriates and so on. But at the same time, there were job evaluations that were carried out to try and streamline the public service and so on, and coming up with all sorts of pay structures. Because initially, it was like maybe just standard sevens and junior secondary schools leavers who were even in higher positions at that time. It worked for us, yes, but the time changed, and therefore structures also had to change to cope with the complexities. So in the early 1990s, we also realized that it was getting difficult to manage a lot of these systems that we had manually. But at the same time, we are blessed in that there were now diamonds being mined and now beginning to start to just bring more revenues, particularly late 80s and, well, something around the 70s, but it was more pronounced in the late 80s and so on, when our diamond revenue really shot up. And of course, with the advent of HIV and AIDS and so on, definitely there were other things. And mind you, all these things in the context of reforms, all these things that I call challenges, most of them are really man-made challenges. They are challenges that come about because maybe we did not understand something in terms of the change process, and that goes back to the person. So now, in terms of context and discussing reforms, therefore, one may, you know, I'll be hopping from state to the individual, because it's through the people themselves that we may achieve what we want to achieve. It's about the shared vision kind of approach, where everyone is a leader. Now, in 1995, the former president Sekou Toumani Massiré, who was actually the second president of this country, came up with a movement that was referred to as Sekou Toumani Massiré movement, productivity movement, where now we're trying to say we need to make sure that we produce more with less. But you see, if you look back into the planning processes and other related issues, you realize development planning and other activities that went with it influenced the kind of results that we got. And it's as straightforward as that. The kind of problems that we are seeing today, they are from yesterday's solutions, and I think Peter Senk is right. So now in 1996, the national vision was then the first vision that was at 30 years of independence. We reflected as the public service to say, well, how are we going to move forward to make sure that people can deliver, we can account for results, and make sure that the promises that we give to the citizens you know, are delivered, you know, and through, you know, the right structures and so on and so forth. But what happened, it was then realized that we had to go for productivity for public service. Because one, they were complacent. Two, there were difficulties in terms of living the value system. And then as a result, we are now trying to introduce too many laws, too many that, regulations, code of conduct, that. You see, it doesn't matter how many times, how many of them you produce. If the vision is not shared, if there's no connection in terms of spirit, in order for us to have the eager and the energy to make things happen, then, you know, it will just be talk. And then later we said, okay, now we need to measure performance. Trouble. That's where trouble started. Because in the first place, performance management is good, yes, but it all depends. It all matters as to whether you tick the clock when they come in at 7:30, and you stop it when they knock off at 4:30, and checking as to what was done and what kind of output and so on was starting to be a challenge. And why would we focus on small things when you don't understand the big things? See, now strategic planning became key. So now to say, we need to plan, we need to do that. That's when we introduced, in fact, the first thing that we did in the early 90s was to introduce the computers, the human resource, to resharpen the payroll, and so on and mm-hmm. so forth, those computer systems. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, those computer systems were actually mimicking the traditional way of doing things, simply because we didn't map the processes in order to automate to increase efficiency. So in fact, instead we doubled the cost, because we're running two systems, one keeping historical data and the other manual men running at a manual speed and not utilizing the speed of light. So really, this was the first part. The second part was now for performance management in terms of ministries coming up with strategic plans, coming up with visions and so on. But the visions were not necessarily aligned to the visions, the national vision. So alignment was an issue. And therefore, priorities could easily be misinterpreted. So we were able to hold on. Silos, challenge in terms of mindset. It's my ministry is that cross-cutting issues, you know, behaviors of people, still, you know, getting down to the people themselves. So we said, okay, we've introduced systems, but we have to also educate our people. That's why we introduced balanced scorecard, we introduced the entire public service. We use balanced scorecard. In other words, we have performance management tools in place to try and assist us to cascade priorities. Well, if you can measure it, you can manage it, and you can improve it. I think I entirely also agree with Druka that, you know. Mm-hmm. So in terms of chronology, those were the major factors in terms of reforms until now, where now we are trying to move fast with our e-government program so that we move closer to an integrated government. And a government cannot integrate without its people. So at the same time, now we have to widen our communication with the society. Mm-hmm. For example, we have programs like Taking Service to the People, where we go and see how district officers are actually serving the people out there, the destitutes and all those other people, to check how programs are taking people away from poverty. There are small factors that play to the GDP growth. and sometimes we don't pay attention to those. And more important, we were able to carry little studies, but those little studies that we carried were around, we were trying to identify the major problems that this country is actually having. Remember, we are mindful of the fact that we are a middle-income economy. What that means, sometimes I don't know. But at the same time, we know that we are working very hard to move from factor-driven to an efficiency-driven, and making reference to the Global Competitiveness Index, or you know, or Global Competitiveness Report of 2008, where clearly we went some steps up. Of course, we have at some point we're 71 in the world, and out of 134 countries, and we are able to move to 56, and three in Africa. So, yes, those are interesting statistics, but at the same time, you look at the factors that actually lead to that. We are mindful of some of the weak areas, but at the same time, we know that some of these things you cannot solve some of the problems by accelerating maybe by too much push or force. There are processes that you can accelerate, but each time a caterpillar is in its cocoon and is still struggling, still as a butterfly from its pupae, if you break open that thing, you are likely to get a dead smaller than a caterpillar, whatever. But if you give its period to mature, you are likely to get that. But to make sure that you get the end product there, you have to invest. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's now this country. There was a shift, like the history. I gave you a history of how dependent we were on ourselves. Mm-hmm. In terms of doing, putting our education up and so on. But later, when we became independent, that maybe was interpreted as becoming dependent now on government by its people. Because we are not putting as much as we should. This word productivity efficiency is from a mindset change from a self-reliant state as we used to another state that we think we can rely on someone else. So this kind of dependence is not just to government. It's, for example, it's people depending, like at a family level, dependence on uncle, dependence on family trees and so on. But there's now a change because of the education. Now we are starting to kind of break those connections. And you see, what happens is this. If taking from the four bonds, if these four bonds are strong, whatever I can call them, and this is a family, wife and husband, if this is strong, then if you place a child here, that child will not fall through. But if this is weak, that child is going to fall and will be caught by someone else. And that somebody might be the society. And if it's not the society, it's government. Mm-hmm. Now, these structures here at family level are weak. That's why we are able to be penetrated by issues like HIV and AIDS. We know what kills us, but it's simply because the physical is meant is simply because the mental stance and the emotional and the spiritual bonds are weak. It's only the physical. It's like touch and go all the time. And this is like that even when we come up with the so-called empowerment schemes, where we want to empower the citizens. Still, these bonds are still so weak that even when you try to reform in terms of diversifying, we give them loans, the first thing that they will not do is not to finance a loan. It will be maybe to buy a hammer or a Range Rover or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's more surface than, The other problem that we are having is, of course, the bit that I mentioned, which is the thing about being in control, or the thing about seeing life. You see, we're operating from a scarcity mindset, therefore reforms agenda need to function. For example, we say we don't have water in this country, and we are drilling and we are doing all sorts of things, but we are not paying attention to the whole system. You see, we don't understand why the lakes are dry and dry. You see, now, what has happened is that, for example, from 100% of rain in this country, 100% of rain, we asked them, okay, from 100% of rain, how much water first in this country are we able to capture? And the answer is 20%. And from the 20%, how much do we drink? I don't even ask where the 80% is going. We drink from our dams perhaps one third. Where does the one third go? It's taken by evaporation. And then you go and look for more dams. See? That's, it's not that it's, when you ask them, where can we get water? You know where they look? Down, instead of up. You see?
Okay.
So that's one side. So this is why I'm saying, to move the reforms agenda, you have to look at a collective. You have to look at the whole system and make sure that the different parts, you know, can feel, and there's constant collaboration in terms of moving together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So just maybe a little more specifically about this public sector reforms unit here. Have you been involved with it since its establishment?
I was involved with it from 2000 and maybe from 2004. Although I was not based here, but I was at another ministry,
okay,
but dealing with reforms, but working with the big office.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, and this unit was created in with what goal in mind?
So, in fact, I digressed. You should keep bringing me back.
Okay. No. It was
Introduced with the idea of measuring performance.
Okay, so it was
and then it was actually placed in the Directorate of Public Service Management.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was started in earnest in 1999.
Okay.
And then the permanent sector, when a new permanent secretary to the president was put in place in 2003, he decided that it must be moved out of DPSM to Office of the President, and it must directly report to him,
okay,
in order to drive the reforms agenda. But it was based on performance management.
Okay.
But in 2006, in fact 2007, when I came full time here, the focus changed.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we're looking at overall reforms,
okay,
from decentralization, everything. It's still called a unit, but it's headed at the permanent secretary level.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. And I mean, the PSP who thought that that this unit should come from DPSM to the Office of the President, his thinking was that he could have more influence and more control,
yes,
over overall reforms.
He felt that in the first place they are too far; they should be nearer.
Okay.
Because he felt that, as head of civil service, really the reforms agenda is top priority. And therefore that looked at planning, and that also connected it with other structures that actually assisted in reforming. There are other people outside government, including the National Productivity Center,
mm-hmm,
the Vision Council, those structures that are also responsible for, you know, for carrying out some forms of reforms.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. So how many members are there within the unit?
It's a small,
yeah,
but I guess powerful.
Yeah.
Well, they don't say that. It's only me who sees that way. unit of 12 people. And currently we are at 9.
Okay.
With 3 vacancies.
Okay.
Because at the same time, people, once they are here, they get admired and they are easily attracted. Sometimes government is not able to cope. And like the other one just left to join the Swedish as a project manager for 8 countries.
So join where?
The Swedish.
The Swedish.
Yeah.
Okay. And so how are people selected to serve on it? Now you say you have 3 vacancies. Are they just advertised like regular positions, or are they appointments by the office?
Well, they normally we advertise.
Yeah.
But like in any organizations, there are situations where we may have identified specific talent elsewhere.
Okay.
And,
So as you say, you see it as being a powerful unit. Can you talk a little bit about the powers of the unit and what your specific functions and responsibilities are?
Yeah. The power of this unit maybe is not as powerful as you would think or as it sounds.
Okay.
But the power of this unit has been its ability, one, to respond to the needs of the customer, being the public service, because we serve as a lubricant to them,
mm-hmm.
in terms of us changing their minds and hearts. I won't say it's 100%, but we are humbled by that experience that, now they believe performance, they believe targets can be set, but they know the danger of setting targets.
Mm-hmm.
They also believe that systems must be self-sustaining, and we don't have to be pumping money all the time. They have also believed that we can go for a no-rondo policy. In other words, where we serve the citizen better through our e-government one-stop shops.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, they have also got to believe that we need to serve the citizens with a face, and in my view, that's it. And it has also, used a different approach. Instead of using force and threats, the philosophy changed slightly to be responsible. You are there for a reason. God, you are not there by mistake, and so on. And the other thing was that the selection of people sometimes used to run through assessment centers and so on. But we also brought a caution that we rush for assessment centers because we don't mentor, because we don't coach, we don't have role models, and we think that an assessment center can give us something else. Yes, they can help, but there's something that we are not doing. So all those, particularly after changing where expatriates and so on were replaced, and all this came in for fairness and other things. So in my view, the reforms really, the unit worked very well in terms of bringing those. And then also in that, we're instrumental in terms of harmonizing policies and laws that were there to cope with the changes, like the constitution, like, there are some changes. This is a place where, we conquer the unconquered. And as such, we think out of the box most of the time. We have those workout sessions where we really have to think out of the box and understanding that we cannot necessarily sustain ourselves by our past. The challenges of tomorrow are more complex, more diverse, and as such, we have to rely on the future in order for us to survive. And leading from there is what is we are seeing, a challenge,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we have to do.
So can I see if I've got this right? So now you're responsible for in some ways selling reforms to the public at large, to the public service itself.
Selling, doing,
doing,
facilitating, bringing experts, strategic planning, drawing, you know, we draw those.
But this sounds like a mammoth undertaking.
Yeah.
You're really at the heart of,
yes,
of all of these activities.
For example, I drive the NDP 10.
Yeah.
I just finished with parliamentarians right from the top. It's like a flu.
Yeah.
From the top, from AG to the men on the ground.
Sure.
In terms of lubricating the system, this is what I do. I didn't know what form of how we're going to do this, but I was going to just show you how this office is viewed, because this office is actually the right brain of the think tank, if you like, of the permanent secretary to the president.
Okay.
It does not only have in it technocrats, but it also have advocates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You see, small like this.
Yeah.
But you see, at the ministries, there's a small diagram here. Charlie, just excuse me. Just look at that.
Should I hit record?
Yes.
This is part two of the interview with Dr. Kirito Letswa. So I'm just looking at this diagram, and I have a sort of better idea of how, how you're functioning.
So this is the public service reforms.
Right.
And then our job is to facilitate cabinet.
Yes.
And this office.
Yes.
We are the secretary to this body called the Peak Force, where all the permanent secretaries sit.
Okay.
To support the permanent secretary to the president.
Okay.
And then ministry structures have also what is called performance improvement coordinators,
mm-hmm,
who do similar job but at an implementation level to these people here.
Okay.
In terms of implementation of those reforms,
okay,
including at the districts and departments.
Okay.
So this whole body is normally what you do, but if it's the national planning, it's us and the Minister of Finance and Development Planning.
Okay, excellent, excellent. I'm sorry, could I just stop for a moment, please?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. This is part three of the interview with Dr. Kirito Letswa. Thank you, sir. Sorry for that interruption. Okay. So, your task is really... So I guess I'm interested in, as you say, you're sort of lubricating the reforms from the very top to the very bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the challenges of selling a reform process at various levels of governance.
The challenge is people.
Yeah.
Yeah. The challenge, in my view, is people. First, the leadership commitment to the reforms.
Mm-hmm.
Is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And in where there is a lot of, where there is in bureaucratic states, it's very, very important to always hit it from the top. And when there's buy-in there, then there'll be no problem. The other challenge, and also a lesson, is that there's also need to internalize and to leave the value systems. In most cases, we just write our values and put them on a wall, and we don't leave it. So we need to do that. The other thing is that we introduced our reforms initially in a piecemeal manner, and in a manner that was not ordered, and to some extent, it was also hardening the change process. In other words, as much as people are difficult, it is also very important to always have people who are clear and knowledgeable about reforms. You see, in most cases, in developing states like ours, you know, people like in reforms area, they are not necessarily born. They are people who maybe would have excelled in their areas and with interest, and they have a heart, you know, they are brought in. But it takes more than that. So that's one other lesson. So equipping and having the necessary capability and skills, of course, after understanding the context and so on, is also extremely crucial. But more important, you can't reform means to bend, means to make a difference, means to transform. And as such, you can't transform if you don't have a defined Beni platform. You really need to know what is Beni, and the lessons really learned. And each failure should really be a lesson. Mm-hmm. Keep persevering and, you know, soldiering on. So the compelling reason for change must be clearly spelled out, and the reforms must be relevant and appropriate. Mm-hmm. And really, by this I mean, sometimes decisions made at different levels are not communicated in a manner that they should be. And by the time the change is introduced to the very people on the ground, it's like they were not made aware of the change. It's like they are supposed to first they adopt and the idea, and then next put it in practice. That's when they are made aware, and this complicates the change process. Awareness and the campaign, you know, is very, very important. With, you know, the other thing is the idea of harmonization with legislation, because there was a tendency sometimes to ignore the legislation, and we get stuck with some of the things, and sometimes you might even end up in courts. The other thing in reforming that we felt we needed to pay attention to also was the issue of monitoring and evaluating progress. But by this, I'm referring to a situation where we are now very serious with strategic planning, which is actual result-based, cascading right from top from government to a village level. A village having a strategic plan, where we are focusing on building neighborhoods and building families, because it starts there. Most of these problems, we think you can solve them with money, we can't. Of course, there are other ways of, you know, like the quality of joint planning, oneness in terms of moving forward as a country and the world. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the four keys, and these are four drawn circles of causalities that we've established for government, and so in order for us to identify, you know, areas of leverages in all those, and we have been doing that, and you won't believe it, our budget dropped from applying some of those techniques from 120 billion to something like 39 billion. Simply because sometimes we interpret development as infrastructure. And, there are some things that really matter in human development. And for example, if you change the mindset and get people to understand that their health is in their hands. You see,
yeah.
Instead of say I'll build you a hospital, I'll do that. That hospital is there, is instilling, not to say building a hospital is not good, but that hospital is actually instilling a mindset that you know, one day I'll be ill. Yes, we know, but maybe it should be for old people. And coming up with robust policies, like from now onwards, every government building that is going to be put up will have a training room for physical, a gym.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, every building like this will have that. Because it's different. If I had my gym in the morning and I'm here and I'm really under pressure, like I was here at 4:30 this morning, just to connect with other people in Seychelles, we were 2 hours ahead. You know, I need to have a way of, you know, toning down and, you know, meditations and so on. So all of those things, as you know, we see as a possible move or change. Mm-hmm. But the other most important thing that we felt was that cross-fertilization of ideas is extremely important. And we realize that benchmarking is very, very important. Not benchmarking with a burning platform. It's very important. Because when you have a burning platform, you are able to learn from others. You are able to have meaningful conversations with others and so on. And I've seen that happen. A lot of countries, yes, do come here for benchmarking.
Yeah.
In Africa, you know, Nigeria, Namibia, Lesotho, a lot of them, they do come. I've facilitated a couple of countries around, including Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
So in my view, yes, that's the whole idea. So, but when you think of it, you realize that you can transform Botswana, but you realize that at the end, what is Botswana? Is Botswana my world or the world Botswana?
Mm-hmm.
And the same concept apply, is my village, my country, or my country, my village? Because, for example, when you look at issues of land reform, where people we have, you know, this country is the size of France, and we have 1.8 million people, approximately. And I'll complain that I can't have land to build a house. And the complaint will be that, not that there's no land, but just because I can't get space just next to my father. You see, so it's the whole mindset and so on. So these are little things that sometimes we don't see, but later on they hit at us badly. So when you look at it, you realize that you can't just transform Botswana, you have to go regional. And that's why you have SADC.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at SADC, then you have to expand. You know. So really, it's the whole system,
mm-hmm.
and already I'm talking foreign policy and all this.
Right,
so
right.
it's all systems, and
yeah.
and we help everybody.
Yeah, that's certainly admirable when you've got so much on your plate already.
Yes.
One question I wanted to sort of come back to a little bit is this idea of winning support. Because as you say, many other countries come here to look at Botswana and draw benchmarks from it. But within the public sector, especially since public sector reform has a long history in Botswana and has been going on for many years, do you find it difficult to convince people of the importance of reforms or the importance of learning new systems for performance management or these types of things?
It's not.
No.
But initially it was not easy.
Yeah.
Initially, just like introducing a computer system.
Yeah.
In most cases, people associated that with literacy. But if you look at it from the point of view of Maslow's hierarchy of needs,
mm-hmm.
it has got very little to do with skills.
Mm-hmm.
Skills is a hiding place to say, you know, there's a certain ego that I'm holding, that if if this computer is going to be working for me, then there are some certain things that I may not do. And in most cases, corrupt practices. So I don't know how it's like in other countries, but we've found that sometimes e-government not taking off, it was not because it was necessarily a bad thing, but it was just because it was a reform that was going to bring in some security elements in the accounting systems and so on and so forth. And sometimes you address the symptoms of a problem, but if you don't drill down into people, some of these changes may not take off. So
how do you deal with, I guess you would call that sort of resistance from people who may not want these sorts of reforms to come in?
Yeah. No. There's both the polite way and the more difficult way. The polite way is to make sure that we avail everything that we have to avail in order for specific jobs to be executed, and the tools being the person, the necessary workshops and so on, and training through our reviews, performance reviews, and if all that if we fail to perform and we realize it's purely on resistance, then of course we have some other meaningful conversation to make choices between 1.8 million people whom we represent and a family of two perhaps and maybe maximum seven children. And the chances are 1.8 million will win.
I see. And to what extent does your office actually get involved with those sorts of decisions? So if you say a particular ministry is not implementing the reforms as you would like them to...
In fact, I don't even say anything.
So
because everything that I do on behalf of the Permanent Secretary to the President. I'm sent by him.
Yes.
I'm his technical right man.
Okay.
To do those things. And he's also a facilitator. You know, and he has his way of doing it. Sometimes hard, but in most cases, he's somebody who has always, over time, spent a lot of resources on developing people.
Okay.
But when it comes a time when, you know, we feel we've done our part and we can't do it anymore, then we come to those sort of discussion. But I really get involved with high level people, right, maybe up to director level, but more mainly with the executive permanent secretaries, because I'm responsible for their reviews. I'm actually the secretary to those reviews, and chaired by the vice president and permanent secretary to the president. I sit there, it's a three-legged, I'm the technical processor of all those. I analyze them, I receive them, and we have a lot of conversations with them. They prefer to have those conversations with me than with him. When they sign the agreement, really it's clear between me and the permanent secretary. So.
Where did the... inspiration for this, the creation of this unit really come from? Because in my experience, I don't think we've come across a similar sort of unit.
It came from the permanent secretary to the president. Actually, it was Mr. Elijah Lapoyen. I think he left in 1996. Because this concept was really the concept of reforms, particularly work improvement by teams, was borrowed from Japan and Singapore, and they later realized that we needed to have a unit to coordinate those, and later we realized that yes, these teams can improve performance, but It was performed by junior officers, and it was like for competition, because annually they will compete, like we are having a public service convention where the people best performing teams will come and showcase in August.
Okay.
So, and it was like a competition. But later, it was then said, but then how do you manage performance? In other words, how do you reward people who are performing? Because it was just a blanket statement where annual increment for everybody, and so on. And then later, it was the PSP, the current, who actually moved the office from GPSN to here. It's a multifaceted. Sometimes it was difficult. It has been difficult to write down our mandate, what exactly our mandate is, because we do strategic planning, we do development plans, like, you know, when we introduce a reform, that this is how we want to see our development plan. And even if it's a ministry like finance, we just go in and be consultants. And make sure the network is out, and later once you have that development plan, then it's us to cascade it.
Okay. Yes. I'm sorry. As you can see, I'm sort of battling a little bit to get a very clear idea of your mandate, because it's so big.
Yeah.
You're involved at almost every stage, right?
Almost every stage.
Yeah.
Because up to the person. Because at the end, we are holding them accountable for results.
Right.
And remember, in a development budget like our country, where we have 30% development budget and 70% called recurrent for maintenance and other things, of this 70%, 65% is actual personal emolument salaries. And therefore, it's quite a resource, it's quite a chunk. And definitely there must be an accountability system because this is public money. For making sure that there is some kind of return, and that's the only way that actually we can get to socio-economic and social development.
Right. Okay. So, looking back at your time here so far, are there any particular reforms that have been quite successful that you considered Botswana to really be the model in? So obviously performance management is a big one that I've heard quite a lot about and seems to be to have been quite successfully implemented. But are there any perhaps lesser known ones?
Yeah, in fact, we are saying it's a performance management system.
Yeah.
It was, you see, performance management system in our view was a reform, and it was a system at the same time.
Okay, I see.
And then later, other performance management systems came in, like the balance scorecard. It's also a performance management system. But I think the power that was in this was seeing all these reforms. You know, introduce the performance management system, introduce the performance-based reward system, we introduced the balance scorecard, and then introduced the Kaizen, process reengineering, and then introduced integrated result-based management, systems thinking, you know. Now, and then e-government. Now, what is more important about this is that now is we are calling all this a performance management system because they are now integrated.
Okay.
And they become a powerful tool when they are integrated than if you just use one. Because if you are talking about efficiency, you may talk about improving efficiency in terms of a manual process, but once you computerize, it's another story. The other thing that I thought I should mention is that we have this scarcity minds. I'm not negative about ourselves, but sometimes we don't see opportunities when they're abandoned in terms of reforms. And really, I want to zero down on technology here, that it's cheaper For example, to put up a technology system than to build a road. In other words, we can actually bring services, take services to the people much faster electronically than trying to build roads. Not to say roads are not necessary in other areas. Even where there's the most complicated terrain, if you are able to cross once with wireless or whatever, you'll be able to address those people and so on. And this is one way that we have come up with a strategy to try and address the disadvantaged communities in really, really, really rural areas. That's why we are quickly taking technology now. Mm-hmm. So, and again, it's a sinking in a that we thought was much, much better.
So I have another question for you, and I've read this from some of your speeches that you've given, that you have a particular concern about reform fatigue.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what this concern is and how you're dealing with it.
My concern here was that somebody would carry this briefcase with all these tools and go to a rural area and unpack the briefcase. And people just say, you know, plan scorecard, PMS, that. Mm. So all we are saying is, this is for the back office, there's no need. There's one, two, PMS. If you go out to do strategy, make it simple. And those people are not meant to be technocrats. And therefore, the idea is not to divorce what we do from work. In other words, they shouldn't see this as an academic exercise. Okay. We don't have answers, but we can facilitate. We attempt as much as possible to ask the right questions that can take us to the future. We do make those extrapolations.
I wanted to get back a little bit to some questions about popular support, because we spoke a little bit about your interactions with the public and sort of educating them about the reforms and the points of the reforms and these types of things.
To the point that we have TV programs,
interface,
we also have radio programs where every Tuesday, it's Tuesday right now, at 4 o'clock if I open my radio, one minister and a ministry will be on talking about service delivery and the public will be asking, why is this not happening? In my village, this is what we are seeing. Feedback.
Is this something advocated by your office?
It's the ministries are scheduled by this office.
Oh, yes?
Yes.
So you will say to a particular ministry?
They are scheduled right up to April, end of the year. They know. They prepare in advance. They know when they are on, including district commissioners, including the districts. Yeah. They do come brief.
So it's a radio and a TV?
It's radio and then TVs on Tuesdays where we talk productivity and, you know, I program, we make sure every 3 months we are in there.
Yeah.
There's a radio program in the morning where when there's a burning issue, you know, I'll give a brief at around 6:45.
Yeah.
And then after the news at 6:20 until 9 o'clock, they are just asking and commenting on those.
Could you give me an example of a burning issue?
Well, burning issue could be in a village, displaying our mindset in terms of silo. We would put up a dam, and people and the dam will be ready, but people not drink water for the next 1.5 years from the dam.
They will not.
Yeah, you build a dam.
Yeah,
and then it's a village.
Yeah.
They're supposed to take water from the dam.
Yeah.
And they will not, because somebody who are supposed to do other things to take water from the dam to the people did not plan or did not or was not involved or like that.
Okay.
So the public now, they will ask to say, how come the dam is up and we're not drinking? Mm-hmm. It's a burning issue.
Okay.
A school is opened and it has no, we have not put a big school of about 2,000 pupils and we didn't put up a proper drainage system. First, there was no water, mm-hmm. and the school could not be opened. It opened late. And when the water was connected, finally, only realized that the drainage and other things was not up to standard to mm-hmm. cater for such a capacity. So the whole village became stinking. Mm-hmm. So in the next Tuesday, it was a different ministry, but people just digressed and said, tell us about this village, what is happening? So there are such situations. Okay. And that's why we tightened the planning process.
I see. So that's very interesting. And you consider public support to be a critical element in what you're doing. I mean, is it really necessary to have the public
yes,
on board?
Because there is a danger, but not necessarily a big one.
Yeah.
But to fall back to the traditional, that way of doing things, where our forefathers were firm in terms of leadership. To an extent that you can be lashed, you can be, you know, not necessarily your father, but somebody, any old elderly person, when he found you doing something wrong, could actually take action on the spot. And that is changing slightly. But at the moment, the public definitely is in support of the permanent secretary to be firm, because sometimes we are doing some disservice to the public. Long queues, unnecessary delays, and so on. So yes, anybody who attempts to improve things, they will support. And I think they are in support of what we are doing here. It's only that they sometimes think we are very slow.
Okay.
But that's natural.
So that's one of the challenges in maintaining the support is, I guess, trying to emphasize that things take a little bit of time.
Yeah. A little bit of time, but we also go to them.
Yes.
Like we have village, they know now. They have the village development plans and so on. So they know what is going on.
Yeah. Okay.
They are informed.
So if we do, we still have a bit of time? Or?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay, sorry. Okay, I have quite a few more questions, so maybe I'll just ask you a question to wrap up. I mean, there are many people in countries around the world in similar positions, obviously not in exactly similar units like this, but in similar positions to yours in terms of having to convince other people of the necessity of broad-based reform in a number of different areas. And let's say in a country a person comes into a job such as your own on his first day, what's the type of advice that you would give a man like such as yourself who's in this position?
Yeah.
I can rephrase the question slightly to be like, what are the things you wish you had known on your first day in the job that you know now?
Mm. Well, maybe for me it was... Maybe I should. I was already doing this sort of work of, you know, changing the minds and hearts of people towards something and trying to contribute to the world in terms of writings, literature, and publications. But one thing that one needs to pay attention here is that you need to be open-minded. You need to have a heart. Most of the time, you move in the wilderness. You have to persevere. And if you are really knowledgeable, have an idea, those might be your ideas. There are those people who actually own. Because for us, this is an independent structure. It was not there at independence. And like I've shown you here, this piece can easily be cut off. And I'll be cut off. So it's a matter of making sure there's buy-in the leadership And if you step on people's toes at the same time, you do it when it's necessary. And you know, that kind of deep thinking with the leadership, it's very, very necessary why you want to do things. And they may differ with you, but one also needs to know when to step back. There are times when I say, okay, it's me, or I'm out, you see. So not being a threat, but being a value, from a value system point of view, that there are some certain operating principles that I may not cross, and therefore I cannot do if it means taking that and things like that. But open-mindedness is key. Collaboration, asking people, benchmarking, and really being humble, but being at it all the time, because you can't. You have to. It's like a technology office. You have to. Reforms are not static. What we have done now may not sustain us tomorrow, but you also know what it takes to move from what we have now to the next level. And like I said, I've gone through the information age, the knowledge age, and so on, and I'm looking forward to a stage where we'll take nations to a consciousness age. And somebody really for this kind of job need to be that kind of conscious, awake to a lot of things, and holistic in thinking. But it's a very enjoyable job if you are just human. And permanent secretaries, most of them are my friends. We enjoy what we are doing together because we see value in it. But it's more about taking this journey and breaking this rapport from a value-based system and pure work, that you need to bear in mind before you go in. Because without those relationships, then forget it. It can't be forced all the time. The harder you push, sometimes the system will push back much harder than you can resist. So, but open-mindedness, being business acumen, kind of you need to be clear, or else, more so that people are now. It all depends on the state, because sometimes it's easier to do them at a place where there was maybe nothing. You see, and at least you know what you are dealing with. You might think you are a messiah, but where they are introduced and there are too many of them, and you are now calling them one, they are still asking, but now you say there are many, why one? And they say, no, it's just a toolbox. That's it. So that's it. And simplicity is really key. Simplifying very complicated structure stuff, breaking down to pieces is key in my view.
Thank you very much for your time, sir. I know you're very busy, so I appreciate it. That's a great note to end on.